2. Eddie Kasprak makes a catch. Eddie got off the bus at the corner of Kansas Street and Kossuth Lane. Kossuth was a street that ran a quarter of a mile downhill before dead-ending abruptly, where the crumbling earth sloped into the barrens. He had absolutely no idea why he'd chosen this place to leave the bus. Kossuth Lane meant nothing to him, and he'd known no one on this particular section of Kansas Street. But it seemed like the right place. That was all he knew, but at this point, it seemed to be enough. Beverly had climbed off the bus with a little wave at one of the lower Main Street stops. Mike had taken his car back to the library. Now, watching the small and somehow absurd Mercedes bus pull away, he wondered exactly what he was doing here, standing on an obscure street corner in an obscure town nearly 500 miles away from Myra, who was undoubtedly worried to tears about him. He felt an instant of almost painful vertigo, touched his jacket pocket, and remembered that he had left his Dramamine back at the townhouse along with the rest of his pharmacopoeia. He had aspirin, though. He would no more have gone out sans aspirin than he would have gone out sans pants. He chugged a couple dry and began to walk along Kansas Street, thinking vaguely that he might go to the public library or perhaps cross over to Costello Avenue. It was beginning to clear now, and he supposed he could even walk across to West Broadway and admire the old Victorian houses that stood there along the only two really handsome residential blocks in Derry. He used to do that sometimes when he was a kid, just walk along West Broadway, sort of casual, like he was on his way to somewhere else. There was the Mullers near the corner of Witcham and West Broadway, a red house with turrets on either side and hedges in front. The Mullers had a gardener who always looked at Eddie with suspicious eyes until he had passed on his way. Then there was the Bowies' house, which was four down from the Mullers on the same side, one of the reasons, he supposed, that Greta Bowie and Sally Muller had been such great friends in grammar school. It was green-shingled and also had turrets, but while the turrets on the Mullers' house were squared off, those on the Bowies' house were capped with funny, cone-shaped things that looked to Eddie like squatty dunce caps. In the summer, there was always lawn furniture on the side lawn, a table with a sporty yellow umbrella over it, wicker chairs, a rope hammock stretched between two trees. There was always a croquet game set up out back, too. Eddie knew this, although he had never been invited over to Greta's house to play croquet. Walking by casually, like he was on his way to somewhere else, Eddie would sometimes hear the click of the balls, laughter, groans as someone's ball was sent away. Once he had seen Greta herself, a lemonade in one hand and her croquet mallet in the other, looking slim and pretty beyond the words of all the poets. Even her sunburned shoulders seemed wonderfully pretty to Eddie Kasprak, who had at that time been 9, going after her ball, which had been sent away. It had ricocheted off a tree and had thus brought Greta into Eddie's view. He fell in love with her a little that day, her shining blonde hair falling to the shoulders of her culotte dress, which was a cool blue. She glanced around, and for a moment she thought she had seen him, but that proved not to be so, because when he raised his hand in a timid hello, she did not raise hers in return, but only whacked her ball back onto the rear lawn and then ran after it. He had walked on with no resentment at the unreturned hello. He genuinely believed she must not have seen him, or at the fact that he had never been invited to attend one of the Saturday afternoon croquet games. Why would a beautiful girl like Greta Bowie want to invite a kid like him? He was thin-chested, asthmatic, and had the face of a drowned water rat. Yeah, he thought, walking aimlessly back down Kansas Street. I should have gone over to West Broadway and looked at all those houses again. The Mullers, the Bowies, Dr. Hale's place, the Trackers. His thoughts broke off abruptly at that last name, because, speak of the devil, here he was, standing in front of Tracker Brothers' truck depot. Still right here, Eddie said aloud and laughed, son of a gun. The house on West Broadway, which belonged to Phil and Tony Tracker, a pair of lifelong bachelors, was probably the loveliest of the large houses on that street, a spotlessly white mid-Victorian with green lawns and great beds of flowers that rioted, in a neatly landscaped way, of course, all the spring and summer long. Their driveway was freshly sealed each fall, so that it always remained as black as a dark mirror. The slate shingles on the many slants of the roof were always a perfect mint green that almost exactly matched the lawn, and people sometimes stopped to take pictures of the mullioned windows, which were very old and quite remarkable. Any two men who bother keeping a house so nice must be queers, Eddie's mother had once said in a disgruntled sort of way, and Eddie hadn't dared ask for clarification. The truck depot was the exact opposite of the Tracker House on West Broadway. It was a low brick structure. The bricks were old and crumbling in places, their dirty orange hue shading to a sooty black at the building's footings. The windows were uniformly filthy except for a small circular place on one of the lower panes of the starter's office. This one pane had been kept spotlessly clean by kids before Eddie and those who came after because the starter kept a Playboy calendar over his desk. No boy came to play scratch baseball in the back lot without first stopping to wipe at the glass with his ball glove and examine that month's pinup. The depot was surrounded by a waste of gravel on three sides. Long-distance haulers, Jimmy Pete's and Kenworth's and Rio's, all painted with the words Tracker Brothers, Derry, Newton, Providence, Hartford, New York, sometimes stood here in tangled, disordered profusion. Sometimes they were put together, and sometimes they were just cabs or body boxes standing silent on their rear wheels and support struts. The brothers kept their trucks out of the lot at the back of the building as much as they could, because they were both avid baseball fans and liked the kids to come and play. Phil Tracker drove freight himself, so the boys rarely saw him, but Tony Tracker, a man with huge slab arms and a gut to match, kept the books and the accounts, and Eddie, who never played, his mother would have killed him if she had heard he was playing baseball, racing around and getting dust in his delicate lungs, risking broken legs, concussions, and God alone knew what else, got used to seeing him. He was a summer fixture, his voice as much a part of the game to Eddie then as Mel Allen's later became. Tony Tracker, large but somehow ghost-like, his white shirt glimmering as summer dusk drew down and fireflies began to loom the air with their lace of lights, yelling, "You got to get under that ball before you can catch it, Red. You took your eye off in the ball, half pint. You can't hit the goddamn thing if you ain't looking at it. Slide, horsefoot. You get the soles of them kids in that second baseman's face. He ain't never gonna tag you out." Never called any of them by name, Eddie remembered. It was always, "Hey, Red, hey, Blondie, hey, Four Eyes, hey, half pint." It was never a ball, it was always a ball. It was never a bat, it was always something Tony Tracker called an ash handle. As in, "You ain't never going to hit that ball if you don't choke up on the ash handle, hoss foot." Grinning, Eddie walked a little closer, and then the grin faded. The long brick building, where orders had been processed, trucks repaired, and goods stored on a short-term basis, was now dark and silent. Weeds were growing up through the gravel, and there were no trucks in either side yard. Only a single box, its sides rusty and dull. Getting closer still, he saw that there was a realtor's for sale sign in the window. Tracker's out of business, he thought, and was surprised at the sadness the thought carried with it, as if someone had died. He was glad now he hadn't walked over to West Broadway. If Tracker Brothers could have gone under, Tracker Brothers, which had seemed eternal, what might have happened on that street he had liked so much to walk down as a kid? He realized uneasily that he didn't want to know. He didn't want to see Greta Bowie with gray in her hair, her hips and legs thickened with much sitting and much eating and much drinking. It was better, safer, to just stay away. "That's what we all should have done. Just stayed away. We got no business here. Coming back to where you grew up is like doing some crazy yoga trick, putting your feet in your own mouth and somehow swallowing yourself so there's nothing left. It can't be done. And any sane person ought to be fucking glad it can't. What do you suppose happened to Tony and Phil Tracker, anyway?" A heart attack for Tony, perhaps. He'd been carrying maybe 75 extra pounds of meat on his bones. You had to watch out for what your heart might be up to. The poets might romance about broken hearts and Barry Manilow sing about them. And that was fine by Eddie. He and Myra had every album Barry Manilow had ever recorded. But he himself preferred a good, solid EKG every year. Sure, Tony's heart had probably given it up as a bad job. And Phil? Bad luck on the highway, maybe? Eddie, who made his living behind the wheel himself, or had, these days he only drove the celebs and spent the rest of his time driving a desk, knew about bad luck on the highway. Old Phil might have jackknifed a rig somewhere in New Hampshire or in Haynesville Woods up north in Maine when the going was icy, or maybe he'd lost his brakes on some long hill south of Derry, heading into Haven in a driving springtime rain. Those things, or any of the others you heard in those shit-kicking country songs about truck drivers who wore Stetson hats and had cheating on their minds. Driving a desk was sometimes lonely, but Eddie had been in the driver's seat himself more than once, his aspirator riding there with him on the dashboard, its trigger reflected ghostly in the windshield, and a bucketload of pills in the glove compartment, and he knew that real loneliness was a smeary red, the color of the taillights of the car ahead of you reflected on wet hot top in a driving rain. "Ah, shit, the time goes by," Eddie Kasprak said in a sighing sort of whisper, and was not even aware that he had spoken aloud. Feeling both mellow and unhappy, a state more common to him than he ever would have believed, Eddie skirted the building, Gucci loafers crunching in the gravel, to look at the lot where the baseball games had been played when he was a kid, when, it seemed, 90% of the world had been made up of kids. The lot wasn't much changed, but a look was enough to convince him beyond doubt that the games had stopped, a tradition that had simply died out at some point in the years between for reasons of its own. In 1958, the diamond shape of the infield had been defined not by limed base paths, but in ruts made by running feet. They had no actual bases, those boys who had played baseball here, boys who were all older than the losers, although Eddie remembered now that Stan Urs had sometimes played. His batting was only fair, but in the outfield he could run fast and he had the reflexes of an angel. But four pieces of dirty canvas were always kept under the loading bay, behind the long brick building, to be ceremonially taken out when enough kids had drifted into the back lot to play ball, and just as ceremonially returned when the shades of evening had fallen thickly enough to end further play. Standing here now, Eddie could see no trace of those rutted base paths. Weeds had grown up through the gravel in patchy profusion. Broken soda and beer bottles twinkled here and there. In the old days, such shards of broken glass had been religiously removed. The only thing that was the same was the chain-link fence at the back of the lot, 12 feet high and as rusty as dried blood. It framed the sky in droves of diamond shapes. That was home run territory, Eddie thought, standing bemused with his hands in his pockets at the place where home plate had been 27 years ago. Over the fence and down into the barrens. They used to call it the automatic. He laughed out loud, and then looked around nervously, as if it were a ghost who had laughed out loud instead of a guy in $60 slacks. A guy as solid as, well, as solid as. Get off it, Eds, Richie's voice seemed to whisper. You ain't solid at all, and in the last few years the chucks have been few and far between, right? Yeah, right, Eddie said in a low voice and kicked a few loose stones away in a rattle. In truth, he'd only seen two balls go over the fence at the back of the lot behind Tracker Brothers, both of them hit by the same kid, Belch Huggins. Belch had been almost comically big, already 6 feet tall at 12, weighing maybe 170. He'd gotten his nickname because he was able to articulate belches of amazing length and loudness. At his best, he sounded like a cross between a bullfrog and a cicada. Sometimes he would pat a hand rapidly across his open mouth while belching, emitting a sound like a hoarse Indian. Belch had been big and not really fat, Eddie remembered now, but it was as if God had never really intended for a boy of 12 to attain such remarkable size. If he had not died that summer, he might have grown to 6'6 or better, and might have learned along the way how to maneuver his outsized body through a world of smaller denizens. He might even, Eddie thought, have learned gentleness. But at 12, he had been both clumsy and mean, not retarded, but almost seeming so because all his body's actions seemed so amazingly graceless and lunging. He had none of Stanley's built-in rhythms. It was as if Belch's body did not talk to his brain at all, but existed in its own cosmos of slow thunder. Eddie could remember the evening a long, slow fly ball had been hit directly to Belch's position in the outfield. Belch didn't even have to move. He stood looking up, raised his glove in an almost aimless punching gesture, and instead of settling into his glove, the ball had struck him squarely on top of the head, producing a hollow bonk sound. It was as if the ball had been dropped from 3 stories up onto the roof of a Ford sedan. It bounced up a good 4 feet and came down neatly into Belch's glove. An unfortunate kid named Owen Phillips had laughed at that bonking sound. Belch had walked over to him and had kicked his ass so hard that the Phillips kid had run screaming for home with a hole in the seat of his pants. No one else laughed, at least not on the outside. Eddie supposed that if Richie Tozier had been there, he wouldn't have been able to help it, and Belch probably would have put him in the hospital. Belch was similarly slow at the plate. He was easy to strike out, and if he hit a grounder, even the most fumble-fingered infielders had no trouble throwing him out at first. But when he got all of one, it went a long, long way. The two balls Eddie had seen Belch hit over the fence had both been wonders. The first had never been recovered, although more than a dozen boys had tramped back and forth over the steeply slanting slope, which plunged down into the barrens looking for it. The second, however, had been recovered. The ball belonged to another sixth grader. Eddie could not remember what his real name had been, only that all the other kids called him Snuffy because he always had a cold, and had been in use for most of the late spring and early summer of 58. As a result, it was no longer the nearly perfect spherical creation of white horsehide and red stitching that it had been when it came out of the box. It was scuffed, grass-stained, and cut in several places by its hundreds of bouncing trips over the gravel in the outfield. Its stitching was beginning to come unraveled in one place, and Eddie, who shagged foul balls when his asthma wasn't too bad, relishing every casual "thanks, kid" when he threw the ball back to the playing field, knew that soon someone would produce a roll of black cat friction tape and embalm it so they could get another week or so out of it. But before that day came, a seventh grader with the unlikely name of Stringer Dedham tossed what he fancied a change of speed pitch to Belch Huggins. Belch timed the pitch perfectly. The slow ones were, you should pardon the pun, just his speed, and hit Snuffy's elderly Spaulding so hard that the cover came right off and fluttered down just a few feet shy of second base like a big white moth. The ball itself had continued up and up into a gorgeous twilight sky, unraveling and unraveling as it went, kids turning to follow its progress in dumb wonder. Up and over the chain-link fence it went, still rising, and Eddie remembered Stringer Dedham had said, "Holy shit!" in a soft and awestruck voice as it went, riding a track into the sky, and they had all seen the unwinding string, and maybe even before it hit, six boys had been monkeying up that fence, and Eddie could remember Tony Tracker laughing in an amazed, loon-like way and crying, "That one would have been out of Yankee Stadium! You hear me? That one would have been out of fucking Yankee Stadium!" It had been Peter Gordon who found the ball, not far from the stream the Losers Club would dam up less than 3 weeks later. What was left was not even 3 inches through the center. It was some kind of cockeyed miracle that the twine had never broken. By unspoken consent, the boys had brought the remains of Snuffy's ball back to Tony Tracker, who examined it without saying a word, surrounded by boys who were likewise silent. Seen from a distance, that circle of boys standing around the tall man with a big sloping belly might have seemed almost religious in its intent, the veneration of a holy object. Belch Huggins had not even run around the bases. He only stood among the others like a boy who had no precise idea of where he was. What Tony Tracker handed him that day was smaller than a tennis ball. Eddie, lost in these memories, walked from the place where home had been, across the pitcher's mound, only it had never been a mound, it had been a depression from which the gravel had been scraped clean, and out into shortstop country. He paused briefly, struck by the silence, and then strolled on out to the chain-link fence. It was rustier than ever, and overgrown by some sort of ugly climbing vine, but still there. Looking through it, he could see how the ground sloped away, aggressively green. The barrens were more jungle-like than ever, and for the first time he found himself wondering why a stretch of such tangled and virulent growth should have been called the barrens at all. It was many things, but barren was not one of them. Why not the wilderness or the jungle? Barrens. It had an ominous, almost sinister sound, but what it conjured up in the mind were not tangles of shrubs and trees so thick they had to fight for sunspace. It called up pictures of sand dunes shifting away endlessly, or gray slate expanses of hardpan and desert. Barren. Mike had said earlier that they were all barren, and it seemed true enough. Seven of them, and not a kid among them. Even in these days of Planned Parenthood, that was bucking the odds. He looked through the rusty diamond shapes, hearing the faraway drone of cars on Kansas Street, the faraway trickle and rush of water down below. He could see glints of it in the spring sunshine like flashes of glass. The bamboo stands were still down there, looking unhealthily white, like patches of fungus in all the green. Beyond them, in the marshy stretches of ground bordering the Kanduskeag, there was supposed to have been quick mud. I spent the happiest times of my childhood down there in that mess, he thought, and shivered. He was about to turn away when something else caught his eye. A cement cylinder with a heavy steel cap on the top. Morlock holes, Ben used to call them, laughing with his mouth, but not quite laughing with his eyes. If you went over to one, it would stand maybe waist high on you, if you were a kid, and you would see the words Derry Department of Public Works stamped in raised metal in a semicircle. And you could hear a humming noise from deep inside, some sort of machinery. Morlock holes. That's where we went. In August, in the end, we went into one of Ben's Morlock holes, into the sewers. But after a while, they weren't sewers anymore. They were... what? Patrick Hochstetter was down there. Before it took him, Beverly saw him doing something bad. It made her laugh, but she knew it was bad. Something to do with Henry Bowers, wasn't it? Yes, I think so. And he turned away suddenly and started back toward the abandoned depot, not wanting to look down into the barrens anymore, not liking the thoughts they conjured up. He wanted to be home with Myra. He didn't want to be here. Catch, kid! He turned toward the sound of the voice, and here came some sort of a ball right over the fence and toward him. It struck the gravel and bounced. Eddie stuck out his hand and caught it. In his unthinking reflex, the catch was so neat it was almost elegant. He looked down at what was in his hand, and everything inside him went cool and loose. Once it had been a baseball. Now it was only a string-wrapped sphere, because the cover had been knocked off. He could see the string trailing away. It went over the top of the fence like a strand of spiderweb and disappeared into the barrens. Oh, Jesus, he thought. Oh, Jesus. It's here. It's here with me now. Come on down and play, Eddie, the voice on the other side of the fence said. And Eddie realized with a fainting sort of horror that it was the voice of Belch Huggins, who had been murdered in the tunnels under Derry in August of 1958. And now here was Belch himself, struggling up and over the bank on the other side of the fence. He wore a pinstriped New York Yankees baseball uniform that was flecked with bits of autumn leaves and smeared with green. He was Belch, but he was also the leper, a creature hideously arisen from long years in a wet grave. The flesh of his heavy face hung in putrescent strings and runners. One eye socket was empty. Things squirmed in his hair. He wore a moss-slimed baseball glove on one hand. He poked the rotting fingers of his right hand through the diamonds of the chain-link fence, and when he curled them, Eddie heard a dreadful squirting sound which he thought might drive him mad. That one would have been out of Yankee Stadium, Belch said and grinned. A toad, noxiously white and squirming, dropped from his mouth and tumbled to the ground. You hear me? That one would have been out of fucking Yankee Stadium. And by the way, Eddie, do you want a blowjob? I'll do it for a dime. Hell, I'll do it for free.
Belch's face changed. The jelly-like bulb of nose fell in, revealing two raw red channels that Eddie had seen in his dreams. His hair coarsened and drew back from his temples, turned cobweb white. The rotting skin on his forehead split open, revealing white bone covered with a mucousy substance like the bleared lens of a searchlight. Belch was gone. The thing which had been under the porch at 29 Niebolt Street was here now.
Bobby blows me for a dime,
it crooned, beginning to climb the fence. It left little pieces of its flesh in the diamond shapes the crisscrossing wires made. The fence jingled and rattled with its weight. When it touched the climbing vine-like weeds, they turned black.
He will do it any time. 15 cents for overtime.
Eddie tried to scream. Nothing but a dry, senseless squeak came out of him. His lungs felt like the world's oldest ocarinas. He looked down at the ball in his hand, and suddenly blood began to sweat up from between the wrapped strings. It pattered to the gravel and splashed on his loafers. He threw it down and took two lurching stagger steps backward, his eyes bulging from his face, rubbing his hands on the front of his shirt. The leper had reached the top of the fence, its head swayed in silhouette against the sky, a nightmare shape like a bloated Halloween jack-o'-lantern. Its tongue lolled out, 4 feet long, perhaps six. It twined its way down the fence like a snake from the leper's grinning mouth. There 1 second, gone the next. It did not fade like a ghost in a movie. It simply winked out of existence. But Eddie heard a sound which confirmed its essential solidity, a pop sound like a cork blowing out of a champagne bottle. It was the sound of air rushing in to fill the place where the leper had been. He turned and began to run, but before he had gone 10 feet, four stiff shapes flew out from the shadows under the loading bay of the abandoned brick depot. He thought at first they were bats, and he screamed and covered his head. Then he saw that they were squares of canvas, the squares of canvas that had been the bases when the big kids played here. They whirled and twirled in the still air. He had to duck to avoid one of them. They settled in their accustomed places all at once, kicking up little puffs of grit, home, first, second, third. Gasping, his breath short in his throat, Eddie ran past home plate, his lips drawn back, his face as white as cottage cheese. Whack! The sound of a bat hitting a phantom ball, and then Eddie stopped, the strength going out of his legs, a groan passing his lips. The ground was bulging in a straight line from home to first, as if a gigantic gopher was tunneling rapidly just below the surface of the ground. Gravel rolled off to either side. The shape under the earth reached the base, and the canvas flipped up into the air. It went up so hard and fast, it made a popping sound, the sound a shoeshine kid makes when he's feeling good and pops the rag. Second base flew into the air with a similar popping sound, and had barely settled back before the shape under the ground had reached third and was racing for home. Home plate flew up as well. But before it could come down, the thing had popped out of the ground like some grisly party favor. And the thing was Tony Tracker, his face a skull to which a few blackened chunks of flesh still clung, his white shirt a mess of rotted linen strings. He poked out of the earth at home plate from the waist up, swaying back and forth like a grotesque worm.
"Don't matter how much you choke up on that ash handle," Tony Tracker said in a gritty, grinding voice. Exposed teeth grinned in lunatic chumminess. "Don't matter, Wheezy. We'll get you. You and your friends. We'll have a ball."
Eddie shrieked and staggered away. There was a hand on his shoulder. He shrank away from it. The hand tightened for a moment, then gave way. He turned. It was Greta Bowie. She was dead. Half of her face was gone. Maggots crawled in the churned red meat that was left. She held a green balloon in one hand.
"Car crash,"
the recognizable half of her mouth said, and grinned. The grin caused an unspeakable ripping sound, and Eddie could see raw tendons moving like terrible straps.
"I was 18, Eddie, drunk and done up on reds. Your friends are here, Eddie."
Eddie backed away from her, his hands held up in front of his face. She walked toward him. Blood had splashed, then dried on her legs in long splotches. She was wearing penny loafers. And now, beyond her, he saw the ultimate horror. Patrick Hockstetter was shambling toward him across the outfield. He, too, was wearing a New York Yankees uniform. Eddie ran. Greta clutched at him again, tearing his shirt and spilling some terrible liquid down the back of his collar. Tony Tracker was pulling himself out of his man-sized gopher run. Patrick Hockstetter stumbled and staggered. Eddie ran, not knowing where he was finding the breath to run, but running somehow anyway. And as he ran, he saw words floating in front of him, the words that had been printed on the side of the green balloon Greta Bowie had been holding. "Asthma medicine causes lung cancer. Compliments of Center Street Drug." Eddie ran. He ran and ran, and at some point he collapsed in a dead faint near McCarran Park. And some kids saw him and steered clear of him because he looked like a wino to them, like he might have some kind of weird disease for all they knew. He might even be the killer. And they talked about reporting him to the police. But in the end, they didn't.